You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show,
Paddy is now very much in Aden in the south, and the Houthis have their position of power in the north. But of course, this has kind of escalated even again in the last few hours, and the Houthis have been attacked in Sana'a, and there have been two major suicide bombings during Friday prayers.
Yesterday was bad in Yemen, today was much worse, as Islamic State claims responsibility for suicide bombings in Sana'a, which have left scores dead. We'll discuss the potential ramifications with our guests Kathleen Burke and Phil Clark. We'll also look at Russia, where you don't join a currency union. The currency union joins you. We'll consider an outbreak of Rhodes rage in Cape Town and ask how you decide when a historical monument has been overtaken by events. And we'll also discuss a thwarted attempt to put the Democratic in Democratic Republic of Congo and wonder why they're not making Australian prime ministers quite like they used to. All that coming up right now on Midori House on Monocle 24, right now. Time in London is 18.01, 14.01 in New York. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Joining me in the studio are Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and also Phil Clark from the School of Oriental and African Studies. Welcome both back to the programme. We will start tonight in Yemen, which this week has taken several steps closer to the abyss it has been loitering near for some time now. Yesterday, the presidential palace in Aden was bombed by aircraft presumably dispatched by the Houthi rebels who control the capital, Sana'a. Today, suicide bombers have struck two mosques in Sana'a, killing at least 126 people. Islamic State have claimed responsibility, as they did for this week's earlier attack on the Bardo Museum in Tunis. Kathleen, I'll ask you first, is there any reason not to believe Islamic State's claim?
I don't think so. I mean, it's such a very confused situation. You've got the Houthis, the so-called rebels from the north in Sana'a, who are backed by Iran, who are Shia, and then you've got the previous down in the south, there are an awful lot of Sunnis, and then you've got, of course, both Al Qaeda and especially IS, which are Sunnis. So you've got what you've got now is a civil war within a civil war, and poor Aden just wants to be apart from the rest of the country entirely. So there's no obvious reason to me to think it isn't IS, because it's known that several months ago they established themselves in Yemen.
Phil, it is, as Kathleen points out, terribly difficult to understand what is going on in Yemen at a micro level, and quite difficult to understand what's going on with Islamic State at a macro level. But this is in the same week in which, as we've just noted, they've struck in Tunis, which is not long after they've been claimed responsibility for various attacks in Libya. And this is, of course, on top of their ongoing mayhem across Syria and Iraq. Are we getting any the wiser about whether this is an actual centrally controlled entity, or has it become an idea like Al Qaeda did maybe a decade ago, in which sort of various people just did things and then claimed they were acting in that name?
Yeah, I tend to think it's more of the latter, that there's a real incentive for all sorts of groups to claim to be part of ISIS, to kind of join the franchise, if you like. And then there seems to be a real incentive for ISIS to claim attacks by groups that are quite disparate and often disconnected to them. So everybody seems to have an interest in being seen part of this. I mean, another example of that in the last week or so has been Boko Haram also claiming that they have these connections to ISIS, which seems tenuous at the best of times. But, I mean, I think it's interesting because it shows the power of this idea of ISIS and what it kind of represents, that all of these groups would want to latch onto it. But it does make it then very difficult to try and analyze these situations to work out who exactly is doing what, who are the actors, what are their motivations, and what could be done to target them. So the confusion is actually probably quite helpful for these groups as well.
I mean, your point that about it was micro, I think it actually that's what's important, is that it's micro. That I don't think Yemen is in a position to have that we can talk about macro sorts of groups. You've got tribes. You've got a lot of different tribes. They all like each other. They hate each other. My enemy is friend, and so forth. And so it seems to me that you can't analyze something like Yemen from a large vantage point.
Yemen, though looked at from outside, is, it is, for all the reasons you were delineating, a massive headache. There is a civil war in which there's at least one civil war happening, which has some things to do with the wider civil war around it, and it's also its own agenda on top of, aside from that. The United States, of course, has been waging a sort of war in Yemen now for some years. It was one of the sort of first frontiers of its drone campaign. Does the US actually have any good options at this point? Because I guess the question that needs to be asked is, can America, and indeed the world, can we tolerate failed states on both sides of the Gulf of Aden?
I like this idea of tolerating. Is there anything we can do about it? I mean, Aden is important itself. That's important. It was important in the British Empire for obvious ways because it sort of kept an eye on the entire Indian Ocean. So I think the fact that Aden is being encouraged to make sure it's sort of separate from the rest of it is not unimportant. I think we do have to be careful about looking at all... Remember in the Cold War, back in the olden days, where everything that happened anywhere, as far as the Americans were concerned, was connected to the Cold War, whether it was or not. I think we have to be careful at looking at some of these things of trying to impose a big idea. There have been civil wars going on in Yemen for the past two generations. Now, IS, in fact, is a rather new participant, and I think we can't think that the entire situation there is a reflection of that. I think they're like any other movement that tries to say how, that they are attractive and so forth. They latch on to what they can latch on to.
Phil, just a final thought on Yemen. Are we sort of being a bit, I guess, naive or optimistic at this point and even talking about it as a coherent country in any meaningful sense? As Kathleen points out, it has a long history of civil wars. It was two entirely separate countries, I think, as recently as the early 90s. Has the idea of a unified Yemen reached the end of its natural life?
I think it's an identity that still matters to local people. And I think even a lot of the sloganeering in the last few weeks shows that there is some popular desire to maintain that. So the idea of Yemen is still very strong in people's minds. But in terms of the day-to-day running of the state, I think we're seeing a highly divided entity. And I think the issue that's really come to the fore in the last 3 or 4 months is the importance of clan politics, how important very small family-based politics has been in Yemen, that historically, actually, this has always been a fairly cobbled-together state in which clan politics has never gone away. It's ebbed and flowed at certain moments.
It's an argument that could be made about a lot of the Middle East, of course.
Yeah, that's right. And probably parts of Britain as well, I think, from time to time. But it shows that under in moments of stress, actually, the notion of the state can become much weaker, and these sort of previous periods of family-based politics actually come to the fore, and I think we're living in that kind of period at the moment.
Okay, well, let's look now at Russia, and what with one thing and another, suggestions by Vladimir Putin of a closer union between Russia and its neighbours are probably worth listening to. The recently reapparent president has called for a currency union between his country, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. Those in charge in Minsk and Astana have thus far sounded unenthused, but it remains to be seen how much choice they're actually going to have. Kathleen, Vladimir Putin appears to be proposing a unification of three hopelessly tanking currencies. Does this make any actual economic sense as far as it's possible to tell, or is this another one of his empire building wheezes?
Well, I mean, this is the third tier of this particular empire building wheeze. Remember, there was the customs union a year or so ago when it was going to make it easier to trade. Then there was the Eurasian Economic Union.
That's these three countries plus Armenia and awaiting Kyrgyzstan.
And that's been signed into law, and that was supposed to be trade and agriculture and transport and so forth. And now this is the currency union, which more or less says, You use your single currencies in your own local area, but the ruble is meant to be the main currency. And gosh, Russian is going to be the main language, but you can speak Belarus in Minsk, more or less, is what they say. It's a way of incorporating Russia's near abroad. They were states, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. They were republics. Yes, Kazakhstan isn't tanking quite the same way the others are, in fact. It's a large country. It's got, shall we say, oil resources. It's also a pipeline area. So one might argue that, mile for mile, it's in rather better shape than Russia is.
Phil, would those in charge in Minsk and Astana, would they be untowardly paranoid if they heard this suggestion as some sort of threat?
Yes. And I think that explains their sort of lukewarm reaction to Putin's proposals in the last few days. I mean, this is interesting because that these are governments that have been very closely aligned to Moscow in some very key debates in the last 10 years or so. But they sniff here a real sort of loss of sovereignty and have said, look, we would only do this if we could maintain some degree of control over day-to-day monetary affairs. And we're not getting that kind of assurance. So I think they're very, very suspicious of that, which is a real indictment on Putin, actually, that despite the kind of developments that Kathleen talks about, he still can't even convince these allies that this kind of thing is a good idea. So suggests that his kind of his influence in the region is nothing like what he would hope for.
Well, think of it. I mean, in the past year, the ruble has lost 50% of its value against
the dollar.
This is
what I was thinking. This would probably not be the ideal time, I wouldn't have thought, to try and sell people on joining your currency.
Yeah, to adopt the ruble, yes.
Do you get the sense, though, Kathleen, and this has been the key question as we've watched the Ukraine crisis develop, escalate, meander off at tangents over the last year, that Putin has a long-term goal in mind? Or, you know, is there a strategy or is there just tactics? Is he winging it from one day to the next?
Well, there's a long-term goal, which is to bring the Soviet Union back together, only we call it Russia. Obviously, he says that the worst geopolitical tragedy, catastrophe of the 20th century was the loss of the Soviet Union. And he obviously has in mind to try to reestablish by gathering and ingathering the old parts of what were the old Russia. I mean, Ukraine, remember, Kiev was the origins of Russia. So one can see why that's considered so important. I think there's a long-term goal. I think that tactics, is there a strategy? Well, is there anything in between the goal and tactics? Scare the neighbors?
Well, this does appear to be a general underpinning policy. I don't know. It just occasionally strikes me that I sometimes wonder, Phil, and final thought on this, because it just occurs to me, maybe it's the Australian in me. I detected an occasional smirk from Putin. I think there's part of him that finds this amusing. He knows what sort of response this is going to get in the West. I think there's part of him that enjoys the whole Dr. Evil thing.
Yeah, and I think having had 10 days away mysteriously to kind of think about what his next move would be, maybe this is the result of that. I mean, what's fascinating to me is how much he, in some ways, he's trying to replicate the building of the European Union, that this kind of move from a trade bloc to a customs union to a kind of currency union. I mean, every single step is kind of EU light, so it's kind of remarkable in that sense.
Putin, one of Putin's absolute greatest strengths is his unpredictability. We don't know what he's going to do, and that makes it more terrifying. The great thing about the Cold War was that Brezhnev and the American president, in a sense, knew what each other was capable of and what each other was likely to do. And therefore, since I knew what you were going to do and you knew I knew what you were going to do and I knew what you knew what you were going to do, they didn't do it. We don't know what Putin will do.
It is, but it is, and just, I guess, a final thought on this. It's that tactic often attributed to Richard Nixon, what was known within his White House as madman theory, that if the Russians got the idea that Nixon was just crazy enough to just about try anything, then that would keep them usefully on the back foot.
Well, Putin's certainly doing that, isn't he?
He certainly is. On that happy thought, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Kathleen Burke and Phil Clark. Up next, we'll be looking at a couple of stories from Africa, and we'll also head to Australia for the latest salvo of Tony Abbott's charm offensive.
Spring is springing, and it's time to take a close look at how we present ourselves. Our new style survey sits alluringly in our new April issue and will help guide you to the brands, retailers, and designers you need to know to smarten up your act. Here's what our editors have lined up this month.
In the affairs section this month, we venture into the heart of Burma to visit the nation's state television network. Once a military mouthpiece, can it become a proper public service broadcaster?
In the business pages this month, we take up the style theme by visiting the makers and manufacturers behind some of the best-known names in fashion.
The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or become a subscriber. Head to monocle.com to join the club.
The Monocle Weekly. Our original Sunday show brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. Also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh.
Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatised am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
The mantis.
That's pretty kinky.
Headless thrusting.
And a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
So, yeah, I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had a debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Phil Clark from SOAS here in London and Kathleen Burke from University College. We will look now at the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has this week been upholding the convention generally observed by countries which call themselves democratic republics and cracking down hard on anyone who advocates republican democracy. Dozens of activists and journalists were arrested on Sunday at an event in Kinshasa. Four foreign attendees have since been thrown out of the country. There have been further arrests at a subsequent demonstration in Goma. Phil, first of all, what do we know about this event in Kinshasa? It doesn't seem to have been that huge a deal. This wasn't hundreds of thousands of people parading through the main streets demanding regime change.
No, in fact, this was a small workshop of musicians and activists. There were about 70 or 80 people at this event in Kinshasa.
I've had birthday parties bigger than that. Yeah,
exactly, and probably much more entertaining than this event as well. It actually sounded highly technical that what it was doing basically was bringing sort of musicians and protest leaders from Senegal and Burkina Faso to basically give advice to Congolese activists about how they could perhaps mobilize similar protests in the future. So this was kind of the protest before the protest in many ways. But it shows just how jittery Kabila's government is in Congo, that there's been this huge crackdown on that particular event. All of the Senegalese and Burkina Bay activists have been packed up and sent home. A US diplomat who seems to just have been attending this event was also arrested and kind of kept in prison overnight, which of course caused a bit of a diplomatic incident. But this is a massive overreaction by the Congolese government, no doubt about it.
The DRC government, Kathleen, have accused the activists of plotting an insurgency with the backing of the United States, at which point we have to acknowledge that America is not without form in the general vicinity when it comes to removing inconvenient leaders. But does it seem all that likely at this stage that the United States has nothing better to do with its time than foment insurrection in Kinshasa?
One hardly knows how to respond to that one. They don't want him to have another term because they want voters to get in the habit, politicians to get in the habit of doing their terms and then leaving.
Kabila is term limited.
That's right. And the fear is that he won't go away in 2016 as he's supposed to. You see, so the Americans are certainly interested in trying to have the forms of democracy continue on. I mean, give them their due on that. They'd much rather have democracy than anything else. And the idea, I think, is that they're encouraging NGOs and so forth who are taking part in these sorts of things. The thing is that Congo is a place of great minerals. It's a place of incredible violence. It's a place that is pulling itself out of what has been a very bad 50 years. And it only needs to blow up again to the middle of Africa to be full of blood running in rivers. And so, again, the U.S. and every other country is interested in that not happening. But I don't think they're fomenting much of anything.
Phil, what is the general level of confidence that President Kabila will do what it says in the Constitution and pack it in?
Pretty low confidence in Congo at the moment. I think there are real concerns that he wants to stick around. And actually, the US has been an ardent supporter of Kabila up until this stage. The US and other donors turned a blind eye when Kabila started shooting on protesters and members of opposition parties at the last two elections. So the outside actors are a big reason why Kabila's still in power at the moment. But the bigger threat to Kabila at the moment comes from within his own government. There's a huge amount of discontent within his... He has a cabinet of 45 individuals who represent about 15 different parties. They've been looking to get rid of this guy for a very, very long time. So regardless of what happens in terms of protesters on the streets, Kabila's biggest threat might actually come from the inside.
So we're looking for civil war rather than overthrow.
Yeah, I mean, and there was an attempted coup only about 6 months ago. There was a sort of a minor insurrection of military officials in Kinshasa. I think that's Kabila's bigger worry, is that if enough people get out on the streets, you could then form some sort of coalition between the military and young protesters in particular. What I think is also interesting in this case is how fearful the Congolese government is because of what they've seen in places like Burkina Faso in the last 12 months. So there is this real fear of contagion. And that's why they cracked down on this particular event on Sunday. There's this idea that the ideas and the tactics that were used to overthrow a government in Ouagadougou 6 or 7 months ago could then translate to the Congolese case. So the kind of spreading of ideas between African states is a really interesting phenomenon, I think.
Okay, well, while some activists in Democratic Republic of Congo are arguing about the future, students in South Africa are squabbling about the past. A row has erupted over the statue of Cecil Rhodes at the University of Cape Town after protesters pelted it with a larger amount of the sort of thing that pigeons and seagulls would deposit on it most days. The consequent brouhaha has inevitably been dubbed Rhodes Rage. Kathleen, should Rhodes not be... I mean, he should be extended some credit, should he not? He donated the land on which the University of Cape Town is built. A statue's not asking too much, is it?
Well, it's a problem of what a statue or indeed a monument is meant to do. Is it meant to commemorate? Is it meant to celebrate? I tend to think it can also be there meaning to warn. I mean, after all, if the thing was, if you get rid of something, then all ideas about it disappear, you wouldn't have Auschwitz still there to warn about the future. Rhodes is there two purposes, I think. First of all, how bad things can be, and two, what you can make out of something with a bad beginning. It seems to me that that memory is much more complicated than throwing buckets over a statue, but it also provides a focus, and it seems to me is merely a reflection of a lot deeper issues, like, for example, who is actually teaching the students, which means of 200 full professors, 5 or non-white, for example, the demographic of the student body. They're hanging on Rhodes as much as anything because it's a central point that people can actually respond to. They know who Rhodes is, they know what Rhodes did, and they can say things have not changed since this area. It's very good focus. It's not a dumb thing to have done.
It is a ceaselessly interesting discussion for all the reasons you mention. And there is now a conversation at UCT about, do we take the statue down? Do we just move it somewhere else? Do we hope this all blows over? But of course, this stuff is not uncommon. 25 years ago, during the Soviet Union collapsed, we saw statues of Lenin, hauled down from Vilnius to Vladivostok. Saddam being pulled off his plinth in Ferdus Square in Baghdad. You could even say the IRA blowing up Admiral Nelson in Dublin in 1966. These things can actually... I don't know, is there an argument, Phil, that this sort of desecration of monuments can be a good and powerful thing? It can be saying we have moved past this. I mean, the other example that popped into my head, we talked a lot the other week about the reenactment of the 50th anniversary march from Selma. It kills me that the Edmund Pettus Bridge, of all the bridges in America, is still named after a Confederate general turned Grand Dragon in the Klan.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I was at the University of Cape Town at the end of last year, and there's been a huge amount of discontent amongst black students there for the last couple of years over exactly the issue that Kathleen has mentioned, this kind of almost complete absence of black professors. But there's also been a university crackdown on protests on the campus. The student union has been heavily constrained. And also, I think this is a reflection of wider politics, both within the Western Cape and South Africa as a whole. This real sense, especially amongst young black South Africans, that they are disenfranchised, that they're being cut out of the economy, that the white beneficiaries of apartheid continue to benefit in the way that they have in the past, that Zuma's government hasn't recognised this kind of disadvantage. So there's a huge amount of discontent. What's interesting to me is that Rhodes has become the focal point for all of this. In some ways, that's kind of a crazy anachronism. But on the other hand, there is a symbolism of that statue at UCT. It's enormous. It stands on the side of the hill. You can kind of see it from the roadway. And so it's kind kind of become a target, I think, for a much wider sense of discontent. The other thing I would say is that the protest has actually spread to even Rhodes House at the University of Oxford. As a former Rhodes Scholar as well, I should probably sort of divulge my kind of connection here. I mean, I remember as a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, there was this persistent debate about the ethics of taking Cecil Rhodes's money. And even some Rhodes Scholars, I think, were particularly conflicted about this, that, you know, knowing the misappropriation of funds and the kind of the despotic tendencies of Rhodes, could you in all good conscience take the money? And so we've seen protests in Oxford by Rhodes Scholars even in the last few days, kind of showing solidarity with their colleagues at UCT. So there's also a kind of a wider debate here, which is how, you know, can you build upon these kind of evil legacies? Can you do good with bad things?
That's funny because, I mean, I too was a Rhodes. Oh, gosh, what a clever group we are. And
I dropped out of the University of Sydney twice, but carry on.
No, I mean, we thought back in those days in the last century, we saw it as a way of bringing people in, the ones that didn't necessarily, I mean, this of course, when you look at all of where most of the Americans came from, but nevertheless, there was also always a good mixture of people who would not have been there without Rhodes money, who wouldn't have had the opportunity to do what they could. Not such a bad thing always.
Yeah. Well, finally, though, on a day when Australians across the political spectrum have been joined in heartfelt mourning for former Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser, who has died aged 84, the current occupant of that post and leader of the party for which Fraser won three elections has been wedging his foot ever deeper into his mouth. Phil, he made a somewhat silly and inexplicable video about bullying most recently. He was called on his own behaviour by the ABC's John Fain, who asked him, "You can't, both of you can't imagine how delighted I am to be able to quote this." As a Rhodes Scholar, Fain asked him, how can you say so many stupid things? Phil, is there an answer to that question?
I mean, I'm also so glad we've been able to connect the Rhodes Scholar story to the one about Tony Abbott. But I mean, Abbott really is the gift that keeps on giving, and he'd be hilarious if I weren't an Australian and he was currently my Prime Minister. I mean, this is a man who was quite rightly accused of misogyny by Julia Gillard when she was Prime Minister. This is a man who punched the wall next to a student activist in his own Melbourne University days. This is a man who was a pretty terrible boxer as a student at Oxford and who believes that kind of behaviour also fits current Australian politics. This seems to be his approach. Speak first, think second, and use aggression and violence wherever possible.
And then say, I withdraw it. Don't blame me.
Kathleen, is the current leader of Phil and Mai's homeland impressing you so far?
Well, it depends how you mean impress. I think we'll go for a Paul.
He is a peculiar figure, and obviously on a day like today, the passing of Malcolm Fraser, who actually quit the Liberal Party a few years ago in disgust at the rather cranky Conservative organisation it had turned into, especially on Abbott's watch. I mean, Phil, is this just me getting old and cranky? It has been said, or is it right to feel nostalgic at this point for a time at which, and I guess, you know, with Whitlam, Fraser's great rival, dying not long ahead of him, nostalgic for a time at which Australia did give the impression of being run by serious people, like actual grown-ups seem to be in charge?
Yeah, real statesman-like figures who had a role on the international stage, who could speak in coherent sentences and use the power of reason to convince, none of which Abbott seems capable of. But perhaps what's more frightening is that this man was elected by an overwhelming majority of Australians only 2 years ago. So he does seem to resonate with a part of the populace. This kind of very masculine, macho, you know, plain speaking approach seems very, very popular, while also being petrifying.
We will have to leave it there. Phil Clark and Kathleen Burke, thank you both very much as ever for joining us at Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mike Wynn, and our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, Tom Edwards is here with Monocle's International Playlist. At 1900 hours, he's followed by Marcus Hippie with The Menu, our weekly food and drink show. I'm back at 2200 for the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson. Midori House returns at 1800 on Monday. For this edition, it's goodbye. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.